This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories. The UN General Assembly passes resolutions affirming sovereignty of Syria in the Golan Heights as well as the right of Palestinians to self-determination. Officials in the U.S. state of Georgia say a hand audit of ballots cast in the presidential race confirms Mr. Biden's victory in the battleground state. Azerbaijan's army says it has entered an area handed back by Armenia as part of a ceasefire deal in Nagorno-Karabakh. Welcome to the program. Our top story this hour. The United Nations General Assembly has approved several resolutions against Israel. The Assembly passed a draft proposal affirming permanent sovereignty of Syrians in the occupied Golan Heights. That happened despite opposition from Israel and the United States. The General Assembly also passed two resolutions affirming the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination and sovereignty over their land. Palestine's Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki hailed the UN measure. He said the overwhelming vote was a natural response from the international community to the Israeli occupation. Maliki called on UN members to shoulder their responsibilities to protect the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people. He also called for practical measures in the face of Israeli violations. Political commentator Richard Silverstein says the UN resolution on Golan Heights sends a message to Israel that its occupation of the region is illegitimate, no matter what the U.S. says.
Well, they're basically reaffirming international law, so they're not telling us anything new. But they are. It is a slap in the face to Mike Pompeo, who was in the Golan up to a few hours ago, or maybe a half a day ago, visiting the Golan for the first time. So it's a very clear response saying that the world community rejects this American claim. It rejects the Israeli claim that its occupation is legitimate and justifiable under international law. So it's a restatement of what is obvious to most of the world, except for Trump and Netanyahu. I think that it also is restating the rights of the Palestinian people to either create their own state if they decide to do that, or if Israel continues to reject the idea of a Palestinian state, then creating a single state that would combine Israelis and Palestinians into a single state. The affirmation of the Palestinian rights in that resolution, of course, is, again, a reaffirmation of what we all know, those of us who believe in international law, to be true, and it's a slap in the face of the delusion of the Israelis and the Americans that they're going to single-handedly be able to redefine what international law is on this.
Officials in the U.S. state of Georgia say a hand audit of ballots cast in the November 3rd presidential election confirms Joe Biden's victory there. Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, I believe, said the audit had aligned very close to what they had in election night reporting. He said there is no doubt that Georgia would certify Biden's victory on Friday, but even after the results are certified, President Donald Trump can request a recount in the battleground state. That's because the margin of Biden's victory is less than 0.5%. On Thursday, Biden slammed as totally irresponsible Trump's challenge of the results of the presidential election.
I think they're witnessing incredible irresponsibility, incredibly damaging messages being sent to the rest of the world about how democracy functions. And I think it is Well, I don't know his motive, but I just think it's totally irresponsible.
Are you concerned he may succeed if he's in your administration?
Biden criticized the Trump administration's refusal to give his team access to key federal agencies. Biden argued the obstruction is affecting his team's ability to create a plan to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. A former vice president has been projected by mainstream U.S. media as the winner of the White House race. Trump has rejected the call and declared himself the winner. He has claimed election fraud, launching several lawsuits in a number of states. However, many of those have either been withdrawn or rejected. In the United States, there has been dramatic political infighting among the Democratic Party following the electoral failure of their so-called quote-unquote blue wave. The Conservative Party is also in disarray as the major support for Donald Trump and the so-called Trumpian Republicans heralds a major shift. Ramin Mazahiri is in Chicago.
Both mainstream parties in the United States have been profoundly shaken by the election results from November 3rd. While the Democrats may prevail in the still disputed presidential election, their so-called blue wave has been universally described as an abject disaster. Despite unprecedented mainstream media support, widespread leftist-based protests, and record fundraising, they failed to retake the Senate, lost seats in the House, lost one governorship, and failed to flip a single state legislature. Because this is a census year, Republicans will control drawing up most of the decade's new electoral maps, causing many to say the election was a disastrous setback for progressive causes.
70% of Republicans, 90% of Democratic voters, are for Medicare for All. They're for the ending of student debt. They're for a UBI to sustain them, especially during COVID. So these things are very progressive, and the Democrats were against them.
Massive infighting among the party elite is being reported. Older and moderate Democrats blame newly popular progressive causes for the losses, but the Democratic Socialists of America, the left wing of the Democratic Party, won 70% of the races and ballot initiatives they endorsed.
The Democrats really aren't progressive. I would attribute their losses to putting up bad candidates, candidates that are very centrist. So this is the strategy of the Democrats: is we need to be more centrist or more rightist centrist, and they'll blame progressives.
The election results were widely expected to be a repudiation of so-called Trumpism, but analysts say they actually cemented the unprecedented political uprising unexpectedly led by Donald Trump. So-called Trumpian Republicans are now expected to reshape the Conservative Party. There seems to be unanimous agreement that regardless of the final outcome of the presidential election, Trump and his family will have increased, not decreased, control over the Republican Party. A pre-election poll asked Republicans and Republican-leaning independents if they considered themselves a supporter of Trump or a supporter of the Republican Party. 60% picked Trump.
Whichever presidential candidate is finally inaugurated, it seems certain that America has undergone a dramatic political shift, which few people predicted and which many are struggling to understand and accept. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A new study says the U.S. poverty rate rose by nearly 2% over the summer. The research was conducted by the University of Chicago, the University of Notre Dame, and the Zhejiang University in China. It says about 7 million more Americans fell below the poverty line over the summer. It says the current rate is almost 0.5% higher than it was before the coronavirus pandemic began. The study links the increase to the end of government assistance programs. It says people are running down their stock of savings, if they had any, and are borrowing money to make ends meet. The U.S. reports more than 2,200 new coronavirus deaths in a day, its record high since May, pushing the overall death toll to over 252,000. the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic also has confirmed over 200,000 new infections, which bring the total number of cases to 11.7 million. Meanwhile, in Mexico, death toll from the respiratory disease surpassed 100,000, making the country the world's fourth nation to hit the milestone. Mexico has also confirmed over 1 million positive cases of COVID-19. Elsewhere in the region, Brazil has confirmed a total of nearly 6 million infection cases and over 168,000 fatalities. Total confirmed coronavirus infections in India have passed the milestone of 9 million. India's case tally is the second in the world after the U.S. Total virus deaths in the Asian country is about 132,000. The figures are believed to be much higher due to low level of testing compared to other countries. India has seen a drop in daily cases over the past month, but it is still registering about 45,000 new infections, on average, that is every day. There are concerns that daily cases may see a new spike after a festival was held at the weekend. A prominent human rights group has urged the G20 countries to take action regarding Saudi Arabia's, quote, hypocrisy on women's rights. Amnesty International calls on the leaders of the G20 countries to join the call for immediate and unconditional release of five women's rights activists who were arrested in 2018. Riyadh is set to host the virtual summit of the G20 group to promote the country's reform agenda to the world. However, Amnesty argues that the kingdom's real reformers are behind bars. The rights group stressed these female activists have been subject to torture, ill-treatment, and solitary confinement in Saudi jails. Azerbaijan's army says it has entered the district of Akdam, handed back by Armenia as part of a ceasefire deal in Nagorno-Karabakh. Azeri troops moved into the district of Akdam on Friday, a day after Armenian soldiers and tanks left the region. Armenian forces were there for nearly three decades. Akdam is one of the three districts due to be returned to Azerbaijan under the ceasefire deal clinched last week. The Russia-brokered agreement ended 6 weeks of fighting between the two neighbors over Nagorno-Karabakh. The fighting marked the deadliest in a decades-long dispute over the region. Under the ceasefire deal, Azerbaijan keeps its territorial gains. A recent report on Australian forces' alleged war on crimes in Afghanistan has caused outrage among Afghan human rights groups and activists. The executive director of Afghanistan's human rights and democracy organization called the report disgusting. Hadi Marafat urged the prosecution of those responsible for the crimes. The head of the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission also called for justice for the victims. Shahzad Akbar urged the Afghan government to conduct its own investigation. Inside Australia, the defense minister called the report distressing.
I got the report 2 weeks ago, and it made me physically ill. And it was a very distressing read. Because I know that it certainly didn't represent my service.
These allegations should not overshadow.
Australian Treasurer Josh Frydenberg, or Frydenbergs, I should say, also called the allegations serious. The report was published on Thursday on findings of an inquiry into suspected war crimes by Australian Special Forces personnel between 2005 and 2016. The Australian inquiry found that the forces unlawfully killed 39 unarmed prisoners and civilians in Afghanistan. It also revealed that senior commandos forced junior soldiers to kill defenseless captives to blood them for the combat. Australia has already apologized to Afghanistan. Now, Tehran says it is ready to reverse its nuclear deal countermeasures if Washington returns to the 2015 agreement and honors its commitments. We discussed that issue in our news review program.
Tehran says the Iran nuclear deal has lost its balance of commitments due to Washington's irresponsible conduct and malign policies against the Islamic Republic. Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency said that the U.S. sanctions have deprived the Islamic Republic of benefits perceived in the agreement. Kazem Gharib Abadi said that Iran was ready to reverse its nuclear deal countermeasures if other parties to the accord implement their commitments and lift sanctions on Tehran. Gharib Abadi stressed the landmark nuclear deal includes essential categories of commitments, namely the lifting of sanctions and their effects. And joining us now for this news review is Mr. John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us out of Inderoy. Your initial thoughts on the story, I mean, with a Joe Biden possibly coming in as a new U.S. president come January, do you feel like we'll see any kind of shift in policy when it comes to the JCPOA?
Well, I think firstly that Biden's going to be pretty concerned with and busy with domestic issues. He's facing a massive depression, economic depression in the U.S. because of the COVID lockdowns, as well as, you know, racial tensions and a increasing inequality that has been going on for quite a few years, but it has spiked recently. Biden is going to stock his cabinet with hawks, most of whom, the names I've heard suggested, are all people that worked with Obama, under Obama. And so one can expect it will be a more civil administration, but that the policy is not going to change very much. U.S. foreign policy rarely changes anyway, and Biden has a history of hawkish responses to things, and he was as vice president, he was involved in the plans to remove Assad, the targeting of Assad in Syria. He was a cheerleader for all of Hillary Clinton's stuff in Libya, the assassination of Gaddafi. Coups in South America and Central America. So his foreign policy is, is hawkish imperialism, and it's just going to be, Biden will be, a nicer plantation owner or something, but he's not going to substantially change policy, I don't think. He maybe will pander a little less to Israel. It's interesting that there was already in Israel carried out a strike against Syria post-election, which I think is kind of telling, but he may pander to the Israeli government a little less, but again, policy is not going to change substantially. So when I read constant Western press headlines, there's a sigh of relief in the Middle East. Biden has won the election, and it's a bit of a fantasy to think that somehow Biden is going to be less hawkish. And in terms of the JCPOA, he already is employing language, this paternalistic language that suggests Iran has to, adhere to the tenets and so forth, forgetting that it was the U.S. that tore up the agreement, that Iran has to first adhere to the original tenets and so forth and so on. And this is how the U.S. always treats these kind of negotiations, as if other countries have to abdicate any kind of autonomy and grovel in gratitude that the U.S. is even speaking to them. That's not going to change here, I don't think.
Thank you for joining us out of Inderoy, Norway, Mr. John Stepling, and that is a wrap for the segment of News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
And that's it with international news.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزای لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
کتاب الله.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you a fortnight ago, and here are ayah 37 of Surah Dukhan.
أَهُمْ خَيْرٌ أَمْ قَوْمُ تُبَّعٍ وَالَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِهِمْ أَهْلَكْنَاهُمْ إِنَّهُمْ كَانُوا مُجْرِمِينَ.
Are they better, or the people of Tuba and those who were before them? We destroyed them. Indeed, they were guilty. If you might recall, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah on the denial of the hereafter by the polytheist and the atheist, we had said that any wise person may perceive that the life of the mortal world is not in vain, but has a purpose behind, which necessitates the resurrection and judgment day as the final phase of creation to determine that whatever is sown in the transient life will be reaped in afterlife, with either the blazing fire of hell or the bliss of paradise being the ultimate destination. The ayah that we recited now is an answer to the pagan Arab's claim that the Prophet of Islam is not powerful compared to the ancient kings of Yemen, whose title was Toba, and who had developed a thriving civilization with lush green lands and abundance of agricultural produce. God Almighty says that since they indulged in oppression and corruption, they struck by divine wrath and obliterated, which means you will a similar fate if you continue to worship idols and indulge in sins. This ayah teaches us that, number one, among the methods of the Noble Quran for guiding mankind through appropriate warnings is to refer to the events of the past and the fate that befell the tyrants, even if they were powerful and built a thriving civilization. And number two, certain sins are consequences for infliction of divine wrath in the transient life of the mortal world itself, with the major punishment reserved for the hereafter, such as oppression of the people and a spread of corruption on earth. Now let us listen to ayahs 38 and 39 of this surah.
وَمَا خَلَقْنَا السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا لَاعِبِينَ مَا خَلَقْنَاهُمَا إِلَّا بِالْحَقِّ وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَهُمْ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ
We did not create the heavens and the earth and whatever is between them for play. We did not create them except with reason, but most of them do not know. These ayahs present logical arguments for proving resurrection to the effect that any sensible person may use his intellect to perceive that God Almighty did not create the heavens and the earth and what is between them in vain, but there is divine wisdom in the creation of the whole universe. In other words, the purpose behind creating the heavens and the earth is the creation of the best and most perfect of all species, that is, the human race, and the purpose behind creating mankind is to raise them up on the day of resurrection for due reward or punishment. Otherwise, the creation of the universe would be in vain. This is a firm rebuttal of the flawed perception of the atheists who deny resurrection and the day of judgment, and consider death as the end of everything, while the Noble Quran views physical death as a bridge towards the far greater world. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, it is unreasonable to think of death as the end of everything, as the atheists surmise, because of their lack of belief in the infinite bounties of the Almighty Creator, that are not confined to the transient life of the mortal world, but continue in the realm of the hereafter. Number two, the creation of the universe and the best of all creation, that is, the human race, has a clear purpose behind, as could be perceived by pondering on the wonders of life, the beauties of nature, and the mysteries of the soul with its inherent qualities of love, compassion, respect, patience, piety, honesty, forbearance, construction, quest for knowledge, protection of the environment, sound and healthy family and social life, and etc. With an innate abhorrence towards lies, corruption, oppression, fraud, destruction, hypocrisy, treason, and the various negative tendencies regarded as sins. And number three, among the reasons for denial of resurrection by the disbelievers and the atheists is their gross ignorance of the purpose of creation and their failure to properly use their God-given intellect which is indeed a clear indication of the divine power controlling every minute thing in the universe. Now we listen to ayahs 40, 41, and 42 of Surah Dukhan.
إِنَّ يَوْمَ الْفَصْلِ مِيقَاتُهُمْ أَجْمَعِينَ يَوْمَ لَا يُغْنِي مَوْلًا عَنْ مَوْلًا شَيْئًا وَلَا هُمْ يُنصَرُونَ إِلَّا مَنْ رَحِمَ اللَّهُ إِنَّهُ هُوَ الْعَزِيزُ الرَّحِيمُ.
Indeed, the day of judgment is the tryst for them all. The day when a friend will not avail a friend in any way, nor will they be helped, except for him on whom Allah has mercy. Indeed, he is the Almighty, the All-Merciful. These ayahs refer to some of the features of resurrection and the day of judgment, when everything will be separated from every person, including family and friends, except his or her deeds, unlike the mortal world, where people used to help each other, while now, the salvation is only through divine mercy. To be more precise, since creation has a purpose behind, it is logical for resurrection to occur, because the all-wise Lord does not abandon his creatures after physical death, especially the best of all creation, that is, mankind, which will be gathered all together for due compensation after being shown whatever deeds, whether good or bad, done by each and every person. There will be no helper on that day of justice except for divine mercy, and no wrong shall be done to anyone. Since God's mercy surpasses his wrath, all believers are hopeful of availing it. No matter to what extent bounds have been transgressed, the believers should not be despaired of divine mercy. The pious, however, should be in awe of Almighty God at all times without being proud of their good deeds, since no one knows whether these deeds have been accepted by God, who judges on the basis of sincerity of intention. According to the infallible Imams, for the believers, hope and fear ought to be like the two pans of the balance. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number 1. Resurrection, which is called Yawmul Fasl in ayah 40, means it is the day of separation from all that a person had possessed in the mortal world, including family and friends, except for the deeds he or she had done. Number 2. All human beings will be gathered in one place on that day, from the first created person to the last one, to witness the deeds they had done that will be presented to them more accurately than what a computer, this invention of the human brain, can do. And number 3, God, the just and all-merciful, will judge all on the basis of his infinite mercy, rewarding the virtuous with the bliss of paradise and punishing the disbelievers with the fire of the eternal inferno. Now let us listen to ayahs 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, and 50 of Surah Dukhan as the concluding ayahs of this week's episode.
إِنَّ شَجَرَةَ الزَّقُّومِ طَعَامُ الْأَثِيمِ كَالْمُهْلِ يَغْلِي فِي الْبُطُونِ كَغَلْيِ الْحَمِيمِ خذوه فاعتلوه إلى سواء الجحيم ثم صبوا فوق رأسه من عذاب الحميم ذق إنك أنت العزيز الكريم. إن هذا ما كنتم به تمترون.
Indeed, the tree of Zaqqum will be the food of the sinful. Like molten copper, it will boil in the bellies, boiling like boiling water. Seize him and drag him to the middle of hell. Then pour over his head the punishment of boiling water. Taste. Indeed, you are the self-styled mighty and noble. This is indeed what you used to doubt. The common supposition of hell is that it burns like the fire of this world, but according to Noble Quran, those cast into hell are fed amidst the fearsome blaze with a certain food and water, which in fact cause more horrible tormenting. Zaqqum indicates a kind of undesirable bitter food for the disbelievers in hell that boils in bellies in the manner of scalding water or boiling oil cutting up intestines, as is indicated in Ayah 45 by the use of the word mohl, which means any molten or impure metal such as copper. The punishment of the people of hell is both physical and psychological. If the former is in the form of boiling material, the latter includes humiliation and derision. They will be told, "Taste the consequences of your evil, since you had falsely claimed to be mighty and superior during your mortal world." Ayah 47 commands the angels to seize the unbeliever and drag him forcefully into the midst of fiery blaze of hell, where, as the next ayah says, pour over his head boiling water that cuts the bodily organs into pieces inwardly and burns them outwardly. It is said that these ayahs are a reference to Abu Jahl, one of the most intransigent disbelievers of Mecca, who used to mock Islam and prophets and would say, "I possess power and I am held in high esteem in Mecca, but neither you nor your God may ever inflict any harm unto me." As a consequence for his boastfully blasphemous remarks, he will be held in contempt on the resurrection day, and it will be said to him derisively, "Then taste the torments, since you are mighty and held in high esteem." Ayah 50 means to say that when disbelievers taste the torments, it will be said to them that this is the punishment of which the prophets had warned you about, but you viewed them with doubt and slandered them. These ayahs teach us that, number one, it is one's own sins that take the form of intense fire on Resurrection Day, horribly burning both the outward and inward of the disbeliever. Number two, the punishment in hell will be both physical and psychological. Number three, the tyrants who thought they were mighty, powerful, and wealthy will suffer the consequences of their crimes against humanity and God. And number four, the all-merciful Creator never wrongs anyone, and it is only the disbelievers and intransigent sinners who wrong themselves.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate with me, Gisumisha Ahmadi. tensions are running high between two nuclear-armed neighbors, Pakistani and Indian troops. In this edition of The Debate, we will take a closer look at the long-running dispute over Kashmir and its grave future risks for the region and beyond. Let's get some more updates from our correspondent, Shahana Butt, who's joining us live from Kashmir. Can you please tell us more about this recent incident?
India and Pakistan border skirmishes are not new when it comes to the disputes across the globe. So in 2003, India and Pakistan had signed an agreement on which the two countries agreed to hold their fire so that human casualties and human lives will be saved as human lives matter. But unfortunately, since the agreement was signed, the agreement has never been adhered. And each year, Kashmir witnesses casualties on the borders. People have to flee their homes. They do not settle down at one place, especially those who live on the borders. So again, this year, at least the skirmishes were a little less compared to the past. But now, since this year is towards the end, today's incident has had a great human toll, as we can see that on the two sides, around 10 civilians have died and around five security personnel, again, human lives lost on both sides. So the tensions continue in the region and they have never stopped. And the border skirmishes have resulted in a constant fear among people living on the borders because they have no place to go. And all of a sudden, the tensions rise between the two countries, and all of a sudden, bombardment starts, and artillery is being used, weapons are being used, mortars are being used. And also, more than 20 people have been injured in today's incident. And even now, the two sides have not stopped. There has not been any cap to the violation of ceasefire. Despite the presence of United Nations military observers group on both sides of line of control, the tensions continue, and the United Nations military observers group has not just failed any other organization, but people of Kashmir itself, because people of Kashmir have been long demanding the resolution of the matter in a full-fledged manner in order to avoid more loss of lives, because over the years Kashmir has witnessed a lot of turbulence and violence when it comes to the political sphere and when it comes to the border tensions between India and Pakistan. The two countries have never reached a negotiation table. They've not agreed to resolve the matter. And today, the issue of Kashmir has reached a complex point where not just India and Pakistan are talking about a dispute, but here China has also come into the dispute. So it is now not just a bilateral dispute that India and Pakistan used to talk. It has become a trilateral issue. And also people of Kashmir do want to participate whenever the issue will be discussed. So the tensions between the two countries have mounted again. And as you can see, the civilian casualties. New Delhi says that it is a bid from Pakistan's side to pump in infiltrators into the Indian side. Pakistan, however, denies the accusations. And this blame game goes on and on and on. And it has continued for the past 70 plus years. And the ultimate loss is of the people of Kashmir, who die on every front each day. So here comes the role of international community, who can actually help people of Kashmir live peacefully and resolve, get the matter resolved between India, Pakistan, and all the stakeholders, especially people of Kashmir. And this is what the people of Kashmir want, that resolution involving the people of Kashmir that was promised at the time of the accession of Kashmir with India. So high time for the two countries and global leaders to resolve the matter peacefully and amicably before it turns out to be a nuclear war where there is no end to devastation, disaster, and mourning.
Thank you very much, our correspondent Shahana Butt, live from Kashmir. Now, to elaborate more on that situation, get more details, we're joined by a former Pakistani senior diplomat, Jamil Khan, who is joining us live from Toronto. Now, Mr. Khan, India says that Pakistan initiated the unprovoked ceasefire violation, while Pakistan is also accusing India of the same thing. Who is telling the truth?
It's not the first time. And this year, I think it's over 1,700
LOC violation has taken place, and there have been death toll on Pakistani side, more than what the Indians claim, reportedly. But then that's the issue which can never be resolved if this problem goes on. And this, as has been discussed earlier before me, that it is a flashpoint. My Prime Minister of Pakistan also has indicated, not at one occasion, including Security Council General Assembly session last year, he did indicate that how important it is that the two nuclear armed countries, they are just eyeball to eyeball. And it's not going to really just affect these two countries. And I'm going to come on the international law and how what the international community is required to do, and they are obliged to do according to the resolutions already passed of the Security Council, so that the region is in peace and the people of the region, particularly Jammu and Kashmir, they are able to live their peaceful life according to the human rights and according to the all the international law. So coming back on that point, that this flashpoint, Prime Minister Imran Khan also indicates that Bill Clinton in his tenure had also mentioned that this is the this line of control and this skirmishes and the dispute and the conflict between India and Pakistan, particularly because of the line of control. This is the most dangerous situation of the world. This is what Bill Clinton said. And several think tanks and leaders of the world, they recognize. Unfortunately, they feel that before that stage arrives, the world leaders and the Security Council and perhaps the other powerful members of the Security Council would probably be able to control the situation. But the history of war is very clear demonstration, very clear testimony that it doesn't happen once the war starts. So, A, that both sides are suffering casualties. B, that it's Pakistan troops that they are handicapped, because on that side of Pakistan also they are the same community living in there, particularly same faith, Muslims, and this side. So they normally, Pakistan side has a handicap, and they take a major response. They give a major response only to target the bunkers and all, and in the process sometimes collateral damage, which is basically exploiting them. Let me also tell you the very trick in it. India sometimes initiates this kind of problem because they expect some fire, and then they start blaming Pakistan about the cross border, and they start telling the government, the various community of the world, that is Pakistan which is firing. So this probably riffraff would going on if we only have in our mind the Security Council resolutions, which are about 12 Security Council resolutions, and if initial three Security Council resolutions which were passed, if they are implemented by the world community, by the world organization, that's the United Nations, this problem would no longer be there. But the problem is, instead of blaming each other, the Indians, particularly this regime of Modi, is further aggravating it. Now, according to the Geneva Convention, and according to the Geneva Convention for Article 49, the abrogation of the Constitution 370 and Article 35 of Indian Constitution, that's against those international law, against the Security Council resolution, in which it says that you cannot bring people from outside of that territory and start settling it down. 1.2 million domicile certificates means the residence certificate has been issued against the very characteristic of the whole law. So this even attracts the war crime, which is the Article 8 of the war crime, and it attracts that. So from those international point of view, I would say the international law should be respected, and the international community should intervene. I don't think bilaterally India is willing to resolve this problem. Otherwise,
I'm very sorry I'm cutting you off. We're also joined by a professor of international relations from the University of Westminster, Mr. Debyesh Anand from London, and we would like to also hear from him. Professor, if you could please tell us why India and Pakistan are at odds over Kashmir in the first place.
Thanks for having me here. As your initial reporter from ground level in Srinagar and Kashmir pointed out, that India and Pakistan have been struggling over Kashmir. And of course, we usually see it in terms of proprietorial dispute. That's a territorial dispute between India and Pakistan over who should own the entire state of Jammu and Kashmir, right? And that's the ownership part. And the sad part is what the diplomat earlier was talking about, and he did rightly point out that what the Hindu national government in India is doing is war crime. What's happening in terms of Indian occupied Kashmir is draconian laws and denial of rights to people. That's all happening. But the fact of the matter is, Pakistan has not been very different in that context. And I just found it quite disturbing, I have to say, when the diplomat said that the Pakistani military is in a way more tempered, more measured, because on the other side, Muslims live. I mean, what kind of states are we talking of where the whether you shoot or not, whether you kill or not, depends upon whether you're Muslim or Hindu or whatever. But the sad reality is, this is what's happening with the India and Pakistan. Both of them claim Jammu and Kashmir. Both of them occupy parts of Jammu and Kashmir. Of course, China is also another actor. And both of them play a game. And the sad part, again, as I keep saying sad, because it is a tragic story, is who died today? It's essentially soldiers of India, soldiers of Pakistan. And these soldiers are generally from poor families. Who dies? Occasionally officers. Who dies? Civilians of Kashmir who have never been given right by either India and Pakistan to decide for themselves whether they want India, Pakistan, or independence from both, right? On that matter, when do we find generals, politicians, diplomats, and news anchors ever dying in these wars? And this is what we are dealing with. We are dealing with two states that claim to be post-colonial, but are colonizing people and do not allow people there to exercise their right to self-determination. And that's the real tragedy of this.
Thank you very much. Now back to our guest in Toronto, Mr. Khan. Why has this long-running conflict defied any kind of solution?
Our solution, because solution is not in the hands of these two countries. We tried. Both these countries, they tried entering into a Shimla Accord. And the Shimla Accord, they were hoping that bilaterally they should be able to resolve their problem. But their time and in history has shown that none of the leaders on both sides from in past so many years that they've been able to resolve it. Rather, it further aggravates. So the only solution, to my understanding and to my analysis, is that it's the multilateral solution, because the entire world would get affected. It's not only the two part of this very region and this very continent, but the entire world is going to be affected because of the lethality of both the countries. They are armed to its teeth, and that to nuclear arm. And let me tell you just about 30 seconds about the technical aspect of any flashpoint anywhere in the world. If the nuclear flashpoint takes place, there are about 50 kilometers the smoke or the dust, the radioactive particles, they go into the air and they affect the entire world within 7 days. So I guess the world leader sooner or later would realize they only are under the complacency that probably that stage, before that stage arises, they will step in. One more point I want to add, one of your guests was indicating, and that point is about a military observer. And India here cannot give any justification as to why they do not accord the access to the military observers in their territory. They are always, ever since they were established in 1949 onward, they are always there on the side of the Pakistani territory, and the India never allows them. So if they are gone there, if they go there, I have also worked in the United Nations, at least they would be able to give a neutral account of the incidents which take place, and which I do agree with your guest that this both sides are the human beings. It so happens that they are from one faith or one community on both sides, but then these are somehow factored into the skirmishes and war. And they, as a matter of fact, if I'm the proponent of the human rights, and I am the proponent of the respect for the human lives, basically. So therefore, unless we are able to respect those international law, and if there is any problem, the Security Council should get together and they should invoke the United Nations Charter of 34. And according to United Nations Charter 34, even for this incident we are discussing, they can in a meeting decide to investigate it, so that the countries, they try and refrain from entering into this riffraff and entering into this blame game and entering into escalation of the whole thing, because that is going to lead us to nowhere. And therefore, it's very important that the international law should be respected.
Thank you very much, Mr. Khan. Since you mentioned escalation, that is our next question. Mr. Anand, how likely is this conflict to turn into something serious?
Well, with India and Pakistan, it's always a trigger point. And we have to understand that the Indian government at this point is a Hindu nationalist far-right government that seems to like war, that seems to like conflict, and they feel that Pakistan is a country they can bully. That's one. And second, I mean, we also know that whatever big top government leaders decide, be it on Pakistan side or India side, they cannot always control the narrative on the border. So in my view, at this point in time, given that India is already having tension with China on the border, it's not likely to be in India's interest to increase the border's tension beyond a certain point. But they keep the tensions on, and I have been to one side of the border, and I would like to go to the other side of the border, but I have to say this, that until, and as I agree with the diplomat earlier, when he said that, look, human beings exist on both sides, but we also need to go beyond this whole idea of what identity do they have in terms of religious identity. The reality is, international law is partly a solution, but please remember, in a way, Holocaust was legal according to the Germans. Genocide is often legal. Colonization was legal. So law is not the answer here. What's the answer is when we recognize that the main people who are the stakeholders here are neither India nor Pakistan. It is people of Jammu and Kashmir. And until and unless we highlight their right to self-determination, and UN resolution is good to talk about, but we do know, we have seen what happens with it. I mean, do we really think that UN Security Council, which has China on one side with Pakistan and US and UK and France on the other side, are they really going to do anything about India and Pakistan? No, they don't care. The only talk about is these countries should, so long as maintain peace. Frankly, the peace of the international community is peace of Israel and Palestine, which is essentially a control. So what I would say is, what we need to do is we need to highlight the human story here. We need to highlight that the most important people are Kashmiris. And we need to highlight that until and unless there's a genuine democratization in India and Pakistan. I mean, using the word genuine democratization because India is facing a possibility of Hindu fascism. And of course, Pakistan has a serious role where the so-called establishment is essentially a military state, right? So until and unless there's a genuine democratization both India and Pakistan, and there's Azadi for Kashmiris, which is freedom for Kashmiris, the solution would not be found, right? So a solution, and there is a simple solution. Both India and Pakistan should withdraw from there. Both India and Pakistan allow all, remember, it's not only Muslims. I'm sorry, the diplomat was. People on both sides are Muslims. They are Sikhs. They are Hindus. They are other religious communities. So religion, in a way, that does not is not the most important factor. Most important factor is people of the region should be allowed to live, breathe with dignity, and they should be allowed the right to self-determination, which includes India-Pakistan according to UN resolution, but it has to go beyond it to also include freedom from both. Until unless that happens, I'm afraid we'll be seeing a repetition of these deaths and murders again and again.
Thank you very much. We don't have much time left, so Mr. Khan, if you could please wrap this up. Our other guest from London did mention something very interesting, that law may not be exactly the best solution here. So do you agree with that statement?
No, whatever has been said, ideally, yes. But last 70 years, we have not been able to reach to any solution. So what happens if someone doesn't follow the law? Then obviously the implementer of law, they come and try to implement the law. Now, if the military observers are not accepted, and that's an international law by the India, and if the resolution is not accepted, Pakistan has said several times that let's go for the plebiscite. So plebiscite is not accepted to them. And I totally agree with your guest in London, that Mr. Anand, that yes, they should be given their right of self-determination. This is what the international law also says. This is what I've quoted already about the Geneva Convention, Article 49. And therefore, that is, there is true. But who is going to really, both sides, yes, should have a democratic government. Both sides should have the best of the best leadership. But who is going to bring it down to there? 70 years we have tried. And if it's not being, if it's not happening, then world, and he's right, he's very right. The regional politics is also another group. And because of that regional politics, which is the CPAC, which is the BRI, and which is the opposition by the bloc made by U.S. and U.S. making India as a watchdog of the entire area. And you have seen recently how many agreements have really taken place between the two countries. So this is going to further complicate the situation. It may be because of the China, or may be because human beings and the people inhabitant in that area, they are going to suffer. And unfortunately, without the international law implementation, I don't find any solution. I don't see that in the years to come, we'll have these ideal situations where both the countries are going to sit together and going to resolve their problem bilaterally. It didn't happen 70 years, and it doesn't seem to happen in the next several more years.
Can yes. I just add something in 10 seconds?
Yes, please, go ahead.
I agree with it. Of course, international community's pressure has to be there, but that's not realistic given the power dynamics that's taking place. What's even equally important is, equally important is mobilization of people, progressive, and anyone who